I'm delighted to see you all here at the first meeting of... Some of you may not believe them. We have a number of these brochures posted around the campus, and you can read a little bit about the many, many accomplishments of our speaker, the books he has written, some of the other things that he has done. I thought, as an alternative, that I might just give a short personal reference to Professor Husey, dating back to the time when I met him in 1959 on the University of California campus. I had become acquainted with his writing several years before that time and was delighted to have met him in 1959. But it's been especially interesting to me to meet other persons who had known Professor Rosenstock Husey, become acquainted with his work, because I have found without exception that these persons have been interesting and extremely stimulating people themselves. I think this reflects my own view of tonight's speaker. One person who you may have heard who's included in this circle is Professor Paige Smith, who was on our campus last summer. He was quite well received, and Paige is one of Professor Rosenstock Husey's students from Dartmouth. And with this, it gives me great pleasure to present our speaker tonight, Professor Rosenstock Husey.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm in a position today like the Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland. I have no head of my own for the two lectures announced, because the title of these two lectures, the unifying title, has been stolen. It has not been printed. So here I am, a hatter without a hat, for my two lectures. The Hatter in Alice in Wonderland simply said he had borrowed his own hat from the hat he had to sell. He had no hat of his own. Now, my problem is to make you feel at the end of our 3 days or 2 days better that there is a unifying title. But at this moment, there's none. I have to try to lead you a path without previous general introduction. And let me take then the narrow path next to my own house at this moment in Santa Cruz in California. I live there on one side of a big freeway, and on the other side is the Mission Santa Cruz, which was the first house built in this place by the Franciscans in 1784. And across this big freeway, there leads for the children who go to the mission school a winding staircase and an arch crossing the freeway, so that without danger they can pass over. And on the map, and now comes my hope that this will serve as an introduction, on the map that describes the freeway and my house and the mission and the school, it leaves pedestrian separation for this trip. Now, I've never heard a less fitting term for something very useful and very important. Pedestrian separation, obviously it's a convention. And it is not a pedestrian separation at all. But according to the lingo of linguistics, we have the right to define our terms as we please, so let us be a pedestrian separation, you see? And this is the question of all questions, and that is the problem of our meeting here. Is linguistics in a position to master language and tell us how to speak, what to speak, and to whom to speak? Let me throw out the suggestion that this illness of pedestrian separation separates today humanity. Not only that whole nations and whole continents decline to speak to each other. We had such a violent suppression of speech to the Chinese for the last 15 years in this country. It's now breaking up, fortunately. But all told, there are more and more societies We disclaim any desire to speak to other societies. And for the first time in the history of human speech, people claim the right not to owe the truth to anybody outside their own realm of living. I had just a letter from a Dutch missionary in Russia and Poland, who says the terrible thing is that the alleged Christians there are only half of them honest, and the other lie and are on the side of the communists and report only and spy on us. And it's quite intolerable. I have left my work there. I'm back in Holland now because they don't know what truth is. They don't know the obligation put on us to be truth. We make no distinction. One day they will be, say, tell the truth. It's purely accidental. Well, I think there are some groups in this country who think exactly the same about truth. And you don't have to be in advertising to be fearful about the way the human mind can persuade itself that it doesn't know all the truth to everybody. Speech, then, is today, I think, in a greater danger than it ever has been. And believe it or not, but my conviction is that the next hundreds of years will be a desperate fight for the survival of speech. 2.5 hours by the ordinary teenager are spent in front of television. That's enough to kill anybody's power to speak. In 1890, so quite a while ago, there was a scholar, Abel was his name. He wrote a strange book on the contrary sense, contrary meaning of words. And he drew our attention to the fact that tie and bead, aetus in Latin, is an ambiguous word. It can mean one thing, you see, to be bead, or it can mean height. He thought the same of the color, that blue and black could be the same word, sometimes used in one sense and sometimes the other. He had many other examples. And so he said that at first, men only pointed to things, thought, I don't believe this myself at all, but he thought that language was ambiguous. It could mean two things. You had to be there to understand what your colleague means. If you go to Japan, I'm told I haven't been there, the one Japanese politely will say the weather is, and the other will say the weather is, and how it is, he will not say. Today, of course, he could say it is very beautiful, but tomorrow it won't. And therefore, it was better not to pronounce a dangerous judgment on the character of the day, but invite both parts to form their own judgment together with the other. Quite interesting idea of suppressing the evidence. The lingo of linguistics now goes back from this premise that we can speak as we please if we only define our terms. To define a term means to invent a new word, because it is useless, it is completely independent of what the term could mean, just as pedestrian separation. It could mean that people cannot get together, and it does mean that they get together. Now my problem today is to prove to you that this is not true, that language is not at all arbitrary, and that it is not in the ken of specialists, of professionals, to determine, define their terms. We have so many specialties today, and so we have so many languages, and they are only lingual, they are dialects. What is a dialect? What is a lingual? What is an artificial language? It's a language that can only be spoken to by people who have the same intention, who are, like any specialist, here's a repair workshop, people have to mend the car, they all have to agree what pliers are. It could work if the word flyer was not understood by them. But the thing becomes very different, as a poet goes by and applies himself to flyers. He will not think of flyers in any sense as a work, but he's of a different specialty, of a different profession. And language, in contrast to lingo, only begins when people of different backgrounds, different history, different age, different time, speak the same language. Then it becomes language. The language that a woman and a man speak to each other is the true fountainhead of all language, because since we have incest rules, and since the day, and that was the first day in paradise, that man was not allowed to marry his mother or his sister, he had to learn the language of his wife, and she had to learn his language. And all real language has nothing to do with the themes of the linguistic schools of today, be it Russian or be it American, because they ignore completely the fact that we all, in the middle of life, whether we become monks and take a vow to be virgin Mary, or whether we marry an earthly person, we have to melt two languages into one, two lingos, two dialects into one. Only where there is courtship is two languages. And people who have never made love to a person don't know what language is. And they may be the learned dictionary makers in the world, including Mr. Noah Webster. Language is not a monistic thing, listing words. That language is the power to be, make yourself understood by a person who did not understand you the day before. And if you don't invent for your declaration of love to your sweetheart something highly original, you cannot make love and you cannot get married well. You will get divorced. Yes, most people who are divorced never spoke the same language as their wife. And that's why they have to get a divorce. To get married is a very slow process. And you don't know this, it seems. I advise you not to wonder that people are divorced all the time. You can only wonder that not many more people are divorced all the time. Because they do not take the trouble, besides going to bed together, to learn to speak to each other. And that is marriage. The true marriage of two minds. And Shakespeare knew it, but he has seemed to have forgotten it. I never hear in the rules for marriage laid down by all these wise counselors, ladies and men, that the people have to learn to speak to each other. They take the measurement, whether the breast is wide enough, and the stature is right, and the color of the eyes, pick the other partner. This is totally indifferent. Can they speak to each other a new language that has never been spoken before? Every couple speaks a new language. And linguistics have absolutely nothing to do with it, as they are handled today, because they only speak of people defining their terms. It's certainly an interesting, of course, it can define their terms. Humanity, however, has to renew the eternal language of mankind in a special case of falling in love with the partner of the other, another home, and that's why incest and language has very much to do with each other. Where you have incest, you have no language. And that's the reason why it is, as a big generation, forbidden in the oldest tribe. In no tribe do we find the right to marry the mother or the daughter or the sister. Because they would have perished. The race, our race, dies immediately from degeneracy if this is allowed. And it is an American who in 1872, in the Journal of Anthropology, published at that time in Washington by the government, laid down this very important and very simple rule that incest was not an arbitrary command, the taboo of incest, but was the only way in which human beings could survive. That they would have to come to enemies in their weakness because the race goes down immediately. One of my horses was not tamed in time, and so he married his mother, and the horse from this alliance, which nobody had wanted, was two hands smaller than in an ordinary mating process would have had. So language has very much to do with the fundamental situation of mankind, that he must know to whom he may make love and to whom he shall not. Now that's very serious. And I wanted to bring out today at least this one thing before going on to the linguistic problem of the so-called linguistic tools today. That our own existence is dependent on our speaking to the person we love in a renewal of language. Nobody ever asked how language is rejuvenated. Well, where there is life, there is death. We are only alive because life begets corpses. And then one day you all will be dead and will be a corpse. And the coward doesn't taste it. He subscribes to the scimitar of the beloved and is declared immortal there. As I have heard myself say in California, in Los Angeles, in this fantastic city, you see. By virtue of the powers vested in me, there stands a man with a cylinder, I hereby declare you to be immortal. The cop doesn't answer, of course. And there you have the modern situation of linguistics. Words have lost their meaning, words have lost their power. If such a criminal, fool, can stand up and say, by virtue of the powers vested in me by the trustees of the cemetery, I herewith declare you to be immortal, then an all-time low of human infamy has been reached. That happens in the beautiful state of California. Gentlemen, there is no crime in the world that is as profound as this crime. It's an end to all speech, to all honesty, to all meaning of speech. It's really lingo. Lingo takes the liberty of saying, I define my term. This man defines his term in terms of his salary. He's paid for it, why shouldn't he pay it? There's no other relation to his sentence and the man in debt except the money debt. It's utter nonsense. And yet this goes on day after day. We have all the pieces of art, you know, Raphael imitated, Michelangelo imitated, Death imitated, everything is imitated. Resurrection imitated. This is very serious. Because I suppose, under your noses, I have not seen any student demonstrations against this. But the race is dishonored by these processes. We are. Whether it's advertising or whether this kills language. And I assure you, I'm quite serious. The greatest danger that is ahead of us in the times to come is the dying out of truthful, sincere language which has the power to penetrate, to make alliances so that people are married for good. Ahm has peace for good. For 100 years, this country has not made peace between North and South. This country has not made peace after 1914 to 18 with World War I with the enemy. It has not made peace in 1945. It cannot make peace. Peacemaking is not in the power of the United States. Because they think peace is an act of the will. I assure you, gentlemen, the language is much more profound, and ladies know it anyway. Peace is not an act of the will, but if finally she gets so tired and gives up her will, then there can be peace in the house. That is, peace cannot be willed. That the common language of mankind, the peaceful, loving language, the affectionate language, overcomes us as a surprise. We didn't know the moment before that we would be able to unite with the other person. We were falling. We were not in accord. But then it happened. And the final word, the redeeming phrase, is found under which people can rest in peace. Oh, political scientist, I hope there's nobody here who can say so to me. Our political scientist never mentioned the fact that peacemaking is not an act of human will. it's an admission that it is too difficult to be nailed. It has to be found. Just as any common language between the turning of the two is a very true story. The two have to be changed. And if Harry changes, finally, he doesn't protest when he says that he loves her. Before she spit and was very angry with him. This is so simple that nobody ever mentions these great facts of language, that in every generation, every couple renews the human language by its power to appropriate the language as it is spoken. There's never any problem in these linguistic books how it comes that in every generation there is again speech.
This is just inherited.
This is not inherited. That's absolutely untrue. It has to be learned, and you have to shake off the empty phrases which your parents have been into you, but you didn't understand. And you have to find at least one expression, perhaps a dear, endearing name for your sweetheart, which nobody else understands. And as soon as you have made this progress, taking this one step into reality, that you name your girl with a name nobody ever uses for her, then you can say that you begin to speak. Before it just started. Oh. Now, the tragedy, of course, of linguistics is in this. Today, if you open any book, I hear I brought quite a number of them. One is Russian, one is American. They're always the same. There's no difference. We are a socialist country, they are a capitalist country. No difference. Names have lost their meaning. That's certainly true about all economics. I mean, the Russians are very envious of our social medicine. Well, there are great lists in both books, the Russian and the American. Functional view of language is one for, and the other is for exact methods in linguistic research. I've never read more than because they cannot distinguish serious language and talk. Now, out of the loquaciousness of a child and a teacher and a student, where we just babble and talk and entertain each other and converse, and this language of the law, where once for all murder is penalized by the death capital punishment, there's a tremendous gap. The linguistics lumps this together and says that all of them. Anything that is said once forever is in a quite a different category from these babbling noises which we make and call speech. Talk is not speech. Anything you can handle and retract and say, oh, I didn't mean it. Say it differently, you see, and so you would better understand. All these detours and byways of speech are not speech in the true sense of the word. To list as these two books two frequency tables for a language means to miss the whole point that as in nature there's a tremendous waste, a thousand flowers blossom and one bears fruit, so it is with sentences. You say something, you say something else. But when this one sentence is allowed to stand out for the ages, that he really connected with the martyrdom, as in Lincoln says, he belonged to the ages, then he was a martyr for the cause. Before many people were doing something for the liberation of the slave, but not too much, you know, not against real estate. And therefore, it wasn't him. I mean, half of the people emancipating the blacks in the South didn't mean emancipating them. Just read the news from Philadelphia the other day about this Negro electrician who was gave up his living in the white neighborhood in Philadelphia, town of Benjamin Franklin. So they don't mean what they say. This is there for equality, they are forced for civil rights, they are forced for white equality of white and black, or the people in Central Pennsylvania. You can't find anyone who sides with Governor Wallace. Only in their acts, really. In their acts, they side with Governor Wallace. All their words, therefore, are blown up. What a purpose. They are just nothing. They are not words spoken, but they are words thought. And as long as we do not learn this distinction between talking and speaking, the danger remains that we unlearn to speak. Speech is very, very puzzling, very rare. If I look back in my life, I would only count those moments of a speech where I was in danger of life, where I said something which was true and important, although it could have cost me my existence. These are the things you do not forget. And you have to say it. That there begins to dawn on you that any list of frequency of how often end is used and beg your pardon are utterly unimportant as long as you do not know when they are seriously spoken and when they are just said as a filler. For filling in, of course, he talks in normal sentences. And he would be very surprised if he would be taken up on them. I once had a very sad experience. I gave two talks about the Civilian Conservation Corps and the then Peace Corps. That's 25 years ago, 26 years ago. And I invited, since I was in charge by the President of the United States, all the training of the people in this Civilian Conservation Corps, I invited the Commissioner of Education in Washington. Now, not in the state of Washington, but in the real Washington, you know. And he said it. I feel it. I'm very astounded by it. I don't know why he came, but obviously he was thinking that there was a plot on foot to criticize him. It was not a plot, but he did criticize him. And I was asked to say what we should make them do, what they should make us think. So there were two topics, and I insisted that as now with the anti-poverty program, it was important that these down and out people, the same as the David for poor, when the unemployed, for instance, that they had opportunities to speak to somebody who was not down and out, and that we could not amass camps of 200 unemployed or 50 poor. And I hope for any result that the relation had to be one to one. One successful, one arriving, and the other down and out. That may work. That may encourage both the successful one to know that it was purely accidental that he was successful, and the poor and out that there was hope for him because somebody else left him who was on the other side of the fence. And as long as the economic opportunity program does not lead to through, there will be no lasting success. And you don't know it, also the workers have all read the wrong linguistics. They think if you speak to 50 down and out people, anything can be accepted. Language is, however, always the marriage of two minds. It means always that two people in different positions agree on something. And as long as the fight against poverty is put on the level of social welfare, and if it's well in the apartment, then nothing will happen. That is awful. Quite the contrary, the country will arrive and the guests will be thrown out again. And that's probably going to happen. Because the people just have neither the will nor the imagination nor the patience to demand that the well-to-do and the rich, every one of us takes upon himself the godfather, becoming the godfather of one down and out. As long as you amass the poor, the old man, the poor will become even poor. 50 poor are not less able to be helped than one, obviously. So simple, you see, that we live, however, in a day of statistics, and if you prove that there are 2,000 poor in this town, then the first idea is help the 2,000. The answer is you cannot, as long as you label them statistically, economically, sociologically, as the 2002. Only if they can consider themselves, every one of them, as a friend of a friend of a friend, or in three different classes of the community, will he begin to not himself to be thought of and to consider himself as a poor. And then he will have received the new name in his own imagination and in the imagination of his neighbors. And here comes now the barrier to linguistics. As long as the poor doesn't receive a new name in which poverty is not mentioned, the whole program is utter nonsense. As long as he is helped as a poor, he cannot be helped. Because language is categorical and dogmatic. Because I bear this name myself, and people call me by my name, and I know that I am called by my name, and even worse so, a poor man is so called behind his back. And that's most important. They don't tell him to indicate it, that he belongs to the poor. As little as they don't say to the black man, he's black. Oh, they don't say that. It's polite, you see. Now, anybody who's polite lies. Politeness is not a condition of speech. That's only true for linguistics. Politeness is aggressive, because you don't know how much this man is wedded to his truth. He has not spent his life on this polite way. He only wants to evade you. He's polite. There's the truth. The whole. Any peacetime society in such affluence as we are in this peace, alleged peace, is of course full of politeness, you see. That's the danger point. That's no peace anymore. That's talk. The essence of peace is that the name which I carry in my own consciousness, the son of my father and the son of my mother, a citizen of the United States as I am now, before I was a citizen of Germany, but I am a professor perhaps. I learned to be quite negligent on this line, and I had so many professors that I don't say anymore. Because under the name of professor, a multitude of sins is hidden today. Yes, it is. I was very proud at first as a young man of reaching this up. I was the youngest professor in Germany. But that doesn't help. Doesn't help at all. Titles are very negligent. But you have to learn that the people behind your back have one way of speaking of you. The people to your face have another way of talking to you, and you have an opinion of yourself, and you hope one day there will be agreement between these three attitudes of speech. That's your biography. Some people die in such a way that they learn that what the community thinks of them is the ultimate truth, and what they have thought of themselves is untrue, that they are no good. That happens. That the other way is better, if you can convince the community that not only what they say to your face, that you are a great grand character, but what they say behind your back is identical with what in your own humility you feel is right about yourself. That hasn't to be any megalomania, that hasn't to be any pride. You can think very simply of yourself. So the harmony between these three circles of speech in your inner mind with the people you meet and who talk to you, and the people as they meet in your actions. These three circles are the problem of human speech. Do they harmonize? Then that's it. Do they disintegrate? Do they go farther and farther away from each other? More contradictory all the time, you see? That's all. And then you see that in Saigon, the people demonstrate against the United States, you may well wonder, where are we? That's sad. That has tremendous consequences. This is the ruin of language. There's no one language anymore between even us and the South Vietnamese. I don't know what to say about it. I only can tell you that this is enough to make you weep. because then it has nothing to do with the frequency of the use end or the word better or the word then or the word black or the word white. But it has to do with the relationship between the word and the man who utters it. Is he willing to be killed for this word or is he not? That was the decision the people in Germany had to make under Hitler. And several thousand were slain. And when I said, Emmanuel said, you see, at Harvard University, when I was asked who would resist to Hitler, and I said, oh, there may be all souls, 100,000 souls who will stand upright and prefer to die instead of following this teacher from the abyss. You know what happened in this sophisticated state of Harvard, which at that time counted the years by 1910 instead of 1938? They had just not lived the First World War, did they hear? And so they were very desperate indeed, and they are today. So for this reason, they have not suffered. And so they said to me with a laugh, is that all? 100,000 people? That's not fair. Now you know 100,000 martyrs are more than the Christian Church in all our history has ever seen. It's immense. And the 7,000 which I mentioned before were all killed in the 6 months from August to February 1944 to 1945. And therefore the character of Germany was changed because they were martyrs. And we now don't have to remember Germany as under Hitler as deprived of noble souls. They represent the time of Germany and the not more than the truth. But we still admire Hitler. I know many Americans who still swear by Hitler. Good Americans wouldn't believe it. What is the reason? Because they have unlearned the distinction between two words, words spoken with their whole existence and their whole character at the risk of life and the other. And I began to tell you the story of my commission of education in Washington, D.C., and he's glad that he's not of Washington. Because what they have, the men listened to my wonderful speech, and I took him to my home and gave him something to drink. I'm serious about any of that I did. He didn't deserve it. Because what did he say? He said, you're absolutely right. I heard his point, not one to, you see, not 50 together or 100. Down and out people that the students, the other people mix them. And he said, you're absolutely right. But if you quote me on this, I shall deny it. Now for a commission of education, that's quite a big order. Don't you think? But he said, in my own house to me, if you quote me on this, I shall deny it. And he quoted him on my dissatisfaction with my teaching that I was absolutely right. That's a wonderful example of what is called good politics. He can also call it life. And you can also tell it to call it the poisoning of the world. And we are in the midst of the poisoning of the world, that you know from nobody that he mean it or that he not mean it. Then he just quoted. To tell you as a commission of education that he, I was right, but that if I quoted him on this, he would deny it. If I had to come to the child, I can't tell you, I said. I said, believe it. I said, get it. He didn't have to say anything. But if he said anything about the righteousness or falsehood of my statement, he could not add that he would deny his own truth. For a commission of education. Well, that's the education of commissioners. But we live in this world in which 9/10 of the people think that a good lie is a terrific blessing in this process of life. And for this reason, you must understand that frequency tells us nothing about truth. How often some lie is used, but doesn't improve the lie. Whether a word is true comes only, you see, out of the relation of the speaker to what he says. If he cannot make a dent in the identity of a man's word and of a man's life, then that's it. And wherever you can find an opening, a gap, and drive a wedge between what he says and what he does and what he is and what he thinks, that's stubborn. And that is not speaking. And you cannot learn about the character of speaking anything from those examples by statistics, because these standards all imitate the one true and only honesty. They are very anxious that you are on a track. They all then want to make you believe that they tell the truth. And this is why you can't use the examples, imitation of a diamond, you see. You cannot use to explain a diamond. And since 9/10 of the public utterances of mankind in our newspapers, in our books, in our novels are written for sale, for acclamation, for electoral votes, they imitate truth speech. And because they imitate it, they are not fit to be used in our analysis of human speech. And once you see this, then whole armies of dictionary speech fall down as perfectly useful for explaining the mystery of our speech. The mystery of our speech can only be learned from these very few and rare cases where a man has no other way of surviving than this one word. If you want to know how this happens, just read the speech of the first martyr of the Christian Church, the speech of Stephen. I always wonder how little our theologians, who are accustomed, of course, to write books and to teach, know of the danger of life the first Christians were in when they said anything. There was always stoning ahead of them, or the gallows, or the crucifixion. And therefore, every word in the gospel is so interesting because it was cut out of them in the wildest necessity. They would have preferred to say nothing, because they knew that the gallows were right there. And so any such utterance had a terrific consequence when Stephen was stoned, the first martyr of the Christian Church. Immediately Matthew sat down and began to write his gospel, because for the first time it dawned on these good people that they might all be stoned, they might all be done away with. So you had to write. The writing of the gospel is one of their miraculous stories, and of course no theologian has ever thought of it. That it was so interesting because it was so dangerous. And they only wrote finally in danger of life because it would have been worse if without their written testimony they all would have been wiped out. In order to, there was a two evils, you see. And that's why you need to, till this day, read the gospel, because where you could study words that have consequences, and words that were not spoken by a commissioner of education, if you quote me on this, I shall deny. Peter wanted to deny his Lord, didn't he? He did it twice. But then he saw it couldn't be done. So he was, as you know, crucified head down. Now, I mean this. You see, the word in the Gospel of St. John is written against the linguistics of the modern world as much as of their days. There were plenty of linguistics. There was a great debate on foot in the days of Jesus between Philo, the Jew, and the school of Alexandria, where Philo lived. We are the seven liberal arts. Are they the right background for the human soul, for the enlightenment, and for the bliss of man? Or do you have to go to philosophy, or Philo, as Philo was then saying, to go to the Bible? The debate was very broad, and today it is the same. We also have, as you don't know it, an institution so-called the Liberal Arts College. I understand that you even found yourself in there. If this is so, I wonder if you know what the Liberal Arts College stands for. The Liberal Arts College stands for the seven arts of antiquity, which are this side of religion, and this side of revelation, and this side of speaking with conviction. And that's why they are so dangerous, and that's why so many people love them. This is a place in which nobody is taken up for his conviction, in which you can learn of everybody else's conviction, because then you can read the most wonderful books, from Homer to Shakespeare to Camus. And You haven't to say anything about it. You just enjoy it, as you call it, and you have an intellectual curiosity, the most vicious word ever invented by human speech. I have no intellectual curiosity, I hope, because I would be ashamed if I had it. So it's like a wisdom repair of a woman. The life is full of secrets. Every secret that comes to be there, I'm allowed to know it. But to act from curiosity, something that doesn't give you an education. That's a wrong application of words and of sentences and of reading. Curiosity is too sweet. That's good for 4 years, really. But not for people who already have to read every reading and see whether it's the same as themselves and to respect other people's secrets. So the curious man, you see, denies that secrets are sacred. Otherwise, he would distinguish between the things he's already allowed to know, as they grow upon him, as he does something for them, as he serves his maid, his girl, as he presents her with his own affection. Then she will speak. Then she will open up. But curiosity. Actually, I mean, you read in the papers all these criminals who say that just so curiosity will try to find out about the reaction of a woman or somebody else whom they frighten or whom they rob or whom they tie or whatever they do. This country is quite crazy, derailed by assuming that curiosity has any decency. It is not. If it is applied to ants and cells, it does no harm. It can lead to a scientific study. But if you apply it to human beings, beware of the man who says, he's curious to know you. To tell him that you are not interested. This is one of the great diseases of our time, that in this federal school and educational processes, the mere curiosity is rated as the same thing as an education, which is done in the degree of maturing, of ripeness, is all, as it says in Hamlet. One thing at a time. You cannot know from your gravity, but you may know when the time has come and at which he is telling it and listening. Knowledge is a necessity if it comes at its proper date, and it is horrid if it comes because the boy has an IQ of 160 and, like the low brothers in Chicago, then kills their best friend because it's so interesting. They are so curious to know how such a murder child reacts. Don't think that this is such a long time ago. It's only 40 years ago. The one of them, as you know, was only three years ago. The great case of Dr. Mr. Darrow, as you may know, he was from the gallows. This is curiosity, and is one of the devils of today. The seven little arts are quite innocent if they are not fixing this curiosity. Well, let me tell you who they are. One art was astronomy, one was music, one was geometry, one was arithmetic. They are the quadrillion, the first four little arts. And they all have been baptized and christened by the new modern sciences. Arithmetic and geometry, since the days of Descartes and Copernicus, has reached quite the freedom completely from the purely practical and egocentric sciences of antiquity. And if you look at physics today and music, and you think of Einstein and Beethoven, you know that they are worthy partners of the Christian era. They are inside Christianity. This is not true of grammar. We teach grammar in the same manner as it has been taught in Alexandria 200 years before Christ. And that is an abomination. And that has to come to an end. This is the pre-Christian science to this day. And in order to prove it to you, I'd like to end to give me more time. So much for a question of you. I feel you. The modern Ghanaians have not been able to free themselves from the implications of grammar in the pre-Christian period. And I'm very much concerned to prove to you tomorrow that grammar too has to enter the last 2,000 years of the Christian era, and is, so to speak, waiting at the gate at this moment, and hasn't made its surrender to the spirit of Christianity. It is not so difficult to prove this. It has always been said by pious people in the last 1,000 years that grammar was a pagan science. There's an example on which I may hang up my thesis back in 1179, that's in the days of the Third Crusade, when the world was hungry already for unity as much as it is now, and the people went to Constantinople and to Jerusalem to unite all Christendom and even the whole world. There was a monk in Paris on the left bank where the University of Paris was just falling and beginning to grow. And I myself have printed the oldest commencement address ever given in the West in that year, 1179 or 1180. I found this manuscript, so it's very dear to my heart, this period, in which all the rules of the game of a liberal arts college were invented. And they are suddenly enabled the youth of Europe to study without becoming a monk. You should go to a university after that, you see, and study the liberal arts. And then become a lawyer or physician or whatever you wanted to become. And before, practically for several hundred years, all the learned studies were limited to monastic order. And there were no laity and no knights who could do this. Well, in 1179, this began, 1180. On the left bank of the River Seine in Paris, where to this day Le Café Latin dominates the imagination. The Latin quarter, that is the quarter of the city, and their life on the left bank of the Seine River has made a fork, and he still nourishes yourself with the same principles of a liberal arts education. But what about grammar? Oh, they were very interested in logic, they were very interested in arithmetic and all these other arts, and of grammar, however, the leading spirit of the time had made so much use that the monk of Walter von Wolters of Saint-Victor, one of the secret monasteries in the Café Latin of Paris, exclaimed, "Grammar has given this man over to the devil." Now I would say the same of the communistic and American literature on linguistics today. They are blind in the pre-Christian grammar, has led them astray and made out of grammar something statistical, something in the dictionary, something of the defining of their own terms, something arbitrary. And the work in the life of the Holy Spirit is arbitrary. I can tell you one thing, if there is a Holy Spirit, he doesn't know one thing to be arbitrary. He cooks to the necessary, and if he doesn't this, he wouldn't be the Holy Spirit. To be holy means to be unable to spend and to waste the God-given life on trifles, on statistics, or whatever have you. And especially in language, not to confuse, this is the important thing, the important and the unimportant. I was in love with linguistics all my life. I studied them since I was 12 years old. I composed a dictionary when I was 14. I composed all kinds of biographies of linguists. I only say this in self-defense so that you must not know that I speak of this as though I was not a converted sinner. Language has been the nourishment of my whole life. And so I really think that I should warn you, I know what I'm talking about. As the state of affairs is now, out of the beautiful term philology, which at least implies a love of speech, philo means to love something, and logy is the lover of speech, we have now made linguistics, which shows that they are totally indifferent to what they say. It is something you can handle as male, you can rest in it. And is so terrifying, he cannot speak of language without awe. Because any moment you can lie, any moment you can be real, any moment you can impress somebody, to speak is a very dangerous performance. It's like feeling this high electric shock. And I see now he's resisting, and he's resisting battle with speech, as though he was just something that's tremendous. Now, he's tremendous out here. He's going to the bathtub and all of a sudden, out of the cold water comes the hot water, he's not very good. And so Fleming is a curious thing, but it is more curious. In one sentence he can insert one half of them time. As he did. All these things is things that we listen to, he lets it fall to the speaker. And I shall end on this note in order to prepare my way for tomorrow, is one now already famous example of the arrogance of the linguist who excludes all the people who do not define their terms, all the people who simply listen and obey, obedience is something abnormal in linguistics and in American education. And it is the beginning of it. A man who, a woman who has not obeyed, I'm okay. They don't know what speech is. The first way in which you learn to speak is obedience. There is no other way. And if you don't teach the children to obey, they don't know what truth is. Because they must learn the magic of our truth by being forced from error to obey. And they never forget this, and they apply it to their children, and go to these children, if they don't obey, then they will say, yes, I didn't obey, but you said. Very strange. Obedience is the first form in which you come to know language. But that's very unfathomable. People talk so much that they think talking is speaking. I assure you, talking is not speaking. And all the demonstrators in Germany will not convince you that they speak. They talk. That's not the thing. Now, 30 years ago, there was a conference of the most learned linguists of France and the Arabic and the Roman language. But it should have happened to Slavistic. Which the Germanic language is just the same, and they try to define an imperative. And what is an imperative? Well, as you know, it's something that has to be obeyed. The only say it comes because he thinks the person takes them. And if the person comes, then he says, here I am, the sentence is completed. So any important command is only ended when our system says, here I am. It was a great example of the Hindu grammarian, who were better than the Greek, who says, when is the sentence complete? When the father has said, children, go into the wood, break the tree. Then is the sentence now completed, which the father has said. You know, who knows? Then the children come back and stand before their father and say, the kid is broken. That completes the sentence. And there you see the electric current, you see that circles between these people. He says, go into the woods and break the tree. 2 hours later they stand back, the kid is broken, the sentence can go forward. It's now, you see, ready to be said. Before it was hanging in the air, the sentence. Here I say. Now these venerable rituals from the Hall of my field said, in French, let me use a French example that I can use the name of the letter, the imperative to be found first person prisoner, or may I die. The second, die. The third, let him die. The other, in the third form, let us die. The second is the fifth, you die, and the last, let them die. Have you ever heard that sentence? Because with all these five sentences, all imperative, one is a wish, the other is a possibility, there's only one real imperative in its time, you see. And then comes the act from the other, either men from the theater, take his dagger, and to kill himself or is killed by somebody else. Now this seems to be quite serious. I have nothing against this man or these gentlemen. They are the leading masters of philology. Bruno, Dali, some of you may have seen their work and know their books. But then they're less good than them. Well, most lawyers, all of us, constantly in their social issues, and electricians and doing their serving in touch. And the time that you think is only using his mind. That's how it is. This is always overlooked. And this is not true. Most of my questions only they don't know it. The only person who knows it. Well, why is it only 2 years? In a Dutchman got up at this meeting in 1948, and refuted them all and said, "Society is something that waits for it's obviously pure. If I say 10, and there's nobody who hears me say this and responds, my interest is not completed. The interest is wait for the men who accept this command or correct it for me, for him. And only the men who respond complete the sentence of the entire sentence." Now, many of you who have studied languages will very well know that in all languages the imperative is a shortest form, a form which does not express the present. The present. Ama in Latin is just the root of the word amare, or the same of the Hindus and the German and the French and the Italian. It is the shortest form of the verb, and it waits to be filled with the response of the listener. I do. Whatever. And in this moment, where some obedient person allows the speaker to feel that he recognizes his command as legitimate, the sentence is finished. Just as in the sentence first the twig, the sentence is finished when you see children come back and say the twig has been broken. In the same manner, we all when you give an order to your child, the order is only perfect, perfected, complete. Perfective is the child come and say, "Yes, Mama, what can I do?" That's the meaning. That I feel the child does exactly what the command implies. Now this is unknown and has not penetrated the threshold of the wisdom of the ages of the seven liberal arts gentlemen. And I have really wondered when I read this report of this getting together in this scientific conduction of the Academy of Science in Amsterdam at the Dutch Museum, that it took a gentleman in his dry manner to discover that the six imperatives are legacy. May I die, let him die. But they are mixing all the metaphors to the fact that it is only when I say something and talk for someone who will do it. We are looking for the person who will undergo my treatment and will accept it as directed towards me. Now the lingo of linguistics consists of just that. That you have never been able to change a single sentence out of its alleged isolation. That you analyze sentences, paragraphs, as though they stood by themselves, that you never allow the second person. He is the wife to whom you declare your love and affection. He is the friend to whom you line up for common task. He is the executioner or judge who breaks, you see, the judgment over the criminal. But you have never allowed to overcome the integrity. Drama to this day is a purely pagan activity. Paganism means that one is alone. If you isolate a speaker so that he, his sentences too are analyzed as though he was alone, then of those men, people go mad, and this is the direct outcome of the science of the linguistic science.